Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm happy now to welcome to the program Diane Karp. She's executive director of the Santa Fe Art Institute, and Ricky Ott, who is a community activist, a former commercial salmon fisherman, as opposed to fisherman, and she has a degree in marine toxicology with a specialty in oil pollution. She's the author of several books, including Not One Drop, Betrayal and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill. She teaches all over the country, and last year she got the Environmental Game Changer Award from the Huffington Post. Now, we are here because tomorrow night, Friday the 25th of March at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall, is a panel discussion called Oil Spill, Information Gulf. Diane, welcome. Ricky, welcome.
Hi.
Hi, thank you.
So, Diane, tell us what this is all about. It goes along with an exhibition that you have at the Art Institute.
It actually goes along with a two-year program, and the program is called Half-Life. Patterns of change, and they're patterns of change in all sorts of systems. One of the things that has always fascinated me is that if you go all the way back to the medieval period, scientists and physicians and artists were all members of the same guild. And the reason behind that is that they were all observers of the natural world. Somehow we have disconnected those deep observational and desires to change for the better motivations that are common to all three disciplines. And it's one of the things that has been a driving force at the Santa Fe Art Institute, to bring diverse voices together to talk about very important issues, issues of cultural freedom, social justice, and environmental responsibility. And because this year we are exploring half-life and patterns of change, it seemed that it would be very wise on the anniversary of the huge Gulf spill down in the Gulf of Mexico to bring together artists and scientists and thinkers to explore how we have either covered up truth or revealed truth, how we have brought important issues relating to corporate activity and energy issues and the environment into a discourse that allows the general public to actually understand what's going on. And I think that there's a very different way of approaching problems from the artist's perspective and the scientist's perspective, but they are deep and powerful observational forces, and each of them has an analytical way of engaging the information that they bring to the public. It's fascinating. The greatest artists and the greatest scientists have immense respect for each other because of that broadened discourse that they can provide for each other.
Now, you are having a number of people. We'll be talking to Ricky Ott in a moment. The photographer Debbie Fleming Caffrey will be there, who's from Louisiana and lived here in Santa Fe for a while, has gone back to Louisiana and done a lot of work around fishermen, various people living on the coast, and some of those works
Debbie is actually has grown up on the bayou, and when Katrina hit, I mean, she's been working on documenting the life of the Louisiana Gulf for decades now. And when Katrina hit, Debbie went down to return to her family home to document what was going on, and won the Open Society Institute's Fellowship Award for her revelatory work in black and white photographs of the work of the realities of what was going on in New Orleans during Katrina and down in the bayou as well. And when the Gulf spill happened last year, Debbie was already returned and was working down there with the fishermen community, and began to spend an enormous amount of time weaving together the deep story of the role of oil down there, the role of the fishermen and their relationship with oil. I mean, we think of oil as like the big bad boogeyman, but in terms of the economy, many of these people who live down there can't survive just on fishing and are enormously dependent on oil. So there's not a simple relationship. It's a complex one of economics and environments and social history. And Debbie's work in an extraordinary way with powerful black and white imagery reveals the kinds of subtexts that are often glossed in the media. And that's an incredible role for an artist, and a very important one as well. And she was just awarded the Louisiana Humanities Council Award for Environmental Truth.
And she's been working in tintypes, which is a very kind of ancient, shall we say, photographic medium.
Yes, and she's using, not ancient, but it's an early photographic media. And what she has been doing with the tintypes, which is quite marvelous, is using it as an aspect of narrative so that it becomes the history. And we begin to separate these figures who are, as she calls them, giants, these fishermen who have been involved not only in gathering fish from the Gulf, but also as observers and defenders and powerful players in terms of the culture and society that is sustained by the Gulf. And she separated them out from her other black and white photographs as these sort of foundational figures who most of us probably wouldn't, in ordinary parlance, think of as giants. They're poor fishermen who make a meager living out of the Gulf, but they are also the stewards and the caretakers and the bellwethers for those aspects of destruction that are going on in the Gulf. And they give their lives to go out on the front line and try and clean up and save the wildlife and defend those aspects of the ecosystem that are so vulnerable to things like oil spills.
Another panelist is Aviva Rahmani, who is joining us by phone right now. She's an ecological artist. She's part of the upcoming panel. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to join you all.
So you work with scientists, you work with the environment as an artist, you do ecological restoration. What does that mean? What does that look like?
Well, I think it would be easier for me to answer your question if I went back to what originally inspired me back in the 60s. And that was something that a performance theater person from Poland said, Alejandro Jodorowsky, which was that the only residue of the art ought to be the psychological change in the audience. So when I work with scientists or when I create artifacts from my process, what I'm really after is that point where we can all change to adapt to the kinds of unpredictability that we're experiencing right now in the environment. As an artist, I approach it very differently than a scientist might, but I also use science in my practice. For example, I work with geographic information systems and with modeling devices. When I work with scientists collaboratively, we approach a similar problem, but from very different points of view. And then if the collaboration works well, ultimately the two approaches begin to meld. So, for example, we might look at mapping a degraded area, for example, in the Gulf of Mexico, where you have dead zones. We look at it both from the iterative point of view of statistical information and also from the point of view of how does one sensorially experience these kinds of dramatic changes to our environment? How do you translate that kind of body knowledge of our world into artifacts that the rest of the world, the mainstream, might be able to relate to? And out of that, we develop models that can address how do we restore or live with the consequences of extractive industries and over-exploitation of resources.
So give us an example of one of your artworks that is so closely tied in to the work of science, and then how that's presented to audiences.
Well, probably the best example is a 10-year-long project that I did that was called Ghost Nets, in which I bought a town dump on a remote island in the Gulf of Maine, and I proceeded to restore it bit by bit. I restored it with a combination of studying and monitoring the landscape and learning the geomorphology, not just from a scientific and an observational point of view, but from the point of view of literally walking it. Every day I walked the land for about an hour, and in the process of creating the project, I created pathways through the riparian zone, all in order to prepare us to do the restoration of an estuary at the bottom of the land. The estuary was important because it linked about 70 acres in the migratory bird fly zone. This was translated to the public as a series of stories and images that emerged during those 10 years. And they emerged in people's imagination that an artist had gone to this remote place and bought the town dump and then restored it to a flourishing wetland system. And there were plenty of photographs that emerged and paintings and installations and museum installations and films and so on. But I think what captures people's imagination more than anything is simply that somebody did it, that somebody went someplace remote and took a tiny piece of land and tried to stake a claim that here we're going to try again. Here we're going to start where we messed things up to see if we can work backwards to a better place. I considered that a performative exercise. So it was both a product that created artifacts, which were all the ways in which I analyzed and interpreted what I experienced, but it also created the product of a restored piece of land. And it did create linkage for some fragmented habitat.
One of the things that's so striking about it to me is on the one hand, the fact that it can be done and how inspirational that is, and on the other hand, of how much more needs doing. In other words, how much it takes to do just one tiny part of the whole.
Well, you're right on both counts. The theory that developed was that if we're very careful about how we select these areas to restore, it's called nucleation in forestry, then we don't necessarily have to take on the whole world all at once. We take on the parts that can become catalysts to a larger systemic whole. And the thing to remember is that we're not going to bring it back to something that we've lost. What we may be able to do is find a point of equilibrium within the system so that we don't continue to descend into further and further chaos that is unsustainable for human life. So that's one of the goals.
Now you, I think, are calling this trigger point theory, which is also a body. I think a term that's used in massage.
Well, it is. It's also used in acupuncture, and the premise in acupuncture is that there are points in the body that are meridians for energy, where the energy can become blocked, and we can unblock it by a very small amount of energy given to that area. So if we think of the whole world as a body that right now is extremely sick, you don't take on the whole body at once and indiscriminately. You look for the points where you can generate some healing for the larger system. It's a very anthropomorphic and in some ways romantic approach to the body, but in science, we've often found that metaphors have a tremendous amount of value. For example, the butterfly effect, which does relate to trigger point theory. And my premise is that these sites can be analyzed simultaneously from the point of view of art and science, and that as artists, we actually have the responsibility to integrate scientific principles along with our artistic practice. Both of them are part of our responsibility to observe carefully. It doesn't mean that artists take the place of scientists, but it does mean that we expand our knowledge base and our language systems.
I imagine that for both the artists and the scientists involved in this process, there's a great deal of learning from each other that goes on that really enriches both. And with any luck, that filters out to the public as well.
Oh, it's absolutely enormous, the amount of data that is presented if you work collaboratively with somebody from another system. I've been working for 5 years with Dr. Jim White, who's the director of the Institute for Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And we speak the same language, but we come to it from very different points of view and very different kinds of skepticism. For example, just recently I've been working with the premise of agent-based modeling, which is based on the idea, it's a mathematical approach to systems repair, I guess you could say broadly. And it's the premise that you have all these free agents wandering around doing their own thing on their own terms. And in order to figure out how they all work together, you have to start matching them up. And you do it mathematically. But you could also argue that that's what an artist does. And that's what you do when you work collaboratively. And that's what you do when you work in groups and workshops, as I do, to integrate the knowledge of other systems, other approaches to the environment. You take all these wild cards and you allow them to descend into chaos. And then you start to look for where is the pattern in that chaos, the new pattern that makes a new kind of sense. So to work this way, I think you have to be quite open-minded and willing to fail.
Right, but you have mistakes. To be in both art and science, you have to be willing to fail. Now, if people want to be, if they want to find out more about your work, they can check out the web. What are some websites that they might go to?
Sure, thank you. They can go directly to www.ghostnets.com. That's GHOSNETF.com. That was the name of the project that I spent 10 years on. They can also go to my personal site and see some of the artifacts in a bit more depth, and that is www.avivaramani.com.
And I will link to both of those on my website. Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been quite a pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you on Friday.
Yes, indeed. And we're back on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe talking with Diane Karp and Ricky Ott about tomorrow night's panel discussion called Oil Spill Information Gulf at the Santa Fe Art Institute. And Ricky Ott has been a close observer and participant and activist in both the Exxon Valdez oil spill and the BP oil spill.
So we have to remember that we are actually one day after the 22nd year memorial of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, which up until a year ago was the nation's worst oil disaster. And that's sort of what activated me. I remember flying over the Gulf of Alaska in Prince William Sound and just being so shocked and so stunned and thinking, how can one person possibly make a difference? And then I realized, wait, I know enough to make a difference. Do I care enough? And I had a lot of thoughts right then, but ultimately I decided I did care. And that's what's driving my work still to this day. And the commitment I made on March 24th, 1989, was to work upstream of these oil spills, because I realized as long as we were drilling, we would be spilling.
What does that mean, working upstream?
Working upstream means to help our nation transition off fossil fuel use in my lifetime. I think it's that close, especially for the young people. And I don't want to fall into what Aviva mentioned. She mentioned that we are finding new patterns in chaos. And part of that is correct, but what we need to be mindful of is what I call normalizing the abnormal, so that we recognize when the chaos is actually not chaos, but actually sliding us into destruction, and we don't normalize that. So one of the things we have done is we've said that our oil culture is okay, And we are turned a blind eye to what I call the costs of our oil dependency. This comes out in the Gulf as a cost of losing the land base from subsistence, from subsidence, from taking, as the oil and gas comes out, the land is actually going down, and the scientists have said that 30% of the land loss in Louisiana is directly attributed to oil extraction.
That means the land actually sinks?
Yes, the land actually sinks to, because the oil is being taken out from underneath it.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah, it's actually, and the thing is, the cultures there, I had one Houma native person tell me, you know, we always could hunt and trap and fish, and so we know that as things slid into chaos, we would always be okay. But now they've taken that away from us too. And they is the sort of collection of people that have allowed this oil disaster and the Exxon Valdez to happen. Both of these accidents are not accidents, in fact. They are the predictable result of the oil industry's culture of gaming with our environmental laws. Even the oilmen recognize that our oil dependency is actually threatening our life-supporting climate at this point. And I had oilmen down in Louisiana take me aside and tell me, and I'm talking about older men, and say, look, in the 1920s when the oil industry wanted to come into Louisiana, there was a huge fight. We didn't want the oil industry. We had our fishing, we had our culture, we had our way of life, and we fought it, and we lost. And now the oil industry is part of our culture. So if you're going to take it away, it needs to be done not like falling off a cliff, not like tomorrow, but we need a transition. We need to have our jobs, but they can be different jobs. So I guess what I'm saying is our tendency to rely on this energy source and see it as normal because we dump it in our cars every day. You know, we fuel them with gas. We farm. A lot of our farming is done with petrochemical fertilizers. We don't think twice about eating bananas from, Chile or somewhere 1,500 miles away from our point of origin or from our plate. And this is, we don't think twice about drinking bottled water and the plastic that's involved in it, and maybe that the bottled water is coming also from far, far away. And this is all part of our oil addiction and having the oil be this cheap. And this is not normal to be living like this. What's normal is to recognize that we are part of a living ecosystem, that we're all interrelated, that we all depend on each other, and that we need to take care of it because it takes care of us.
One of the things I was thinking about when Aviva was talking is that you have, she used the word adapting or adaptation, and of course that's one of the fundamental principles of the theory of evolution. And on the one hand, species have been adapting and evolving all along. On the other hand, the idea that human beings, and especially the complex civilizations that we have built up, can adapt to the kind of destruction that we're causing is crazy.
We are in the, I believe, the fifth greatest mass extinction ever to sweep this planet. And just because people can still get in their cars in the morning and drive to their jobs and are insulated in their homes where they can control the climate, everything is okay. But it's not. And what we're not seeing is the ties of the intensity and the frequency of our natural disasters ramping up. What people in the Gulf and California are not seeing are the melting of the glaciers. In my home state, Alaska, we already have climate refugees. In America, I'm talking about Alaska Native people who have had to move away from the coast because the permafrost is melting and the sea ice is not forming up as early in the fall or as late in the spring. So it leaves the coast vulnerable to winter storm and erosion. And villages that are some of the longest inhabited villages in North America, 10,000 years, are having to move. And tell me that's not a trauma. I mean, we think about, you know, Katrina and how people were reluctant to leave their homes, and they've only been down there, you know, a couple generations, the white culture I'm mostly talking about now. But we know the power of home. I kind of want to loop this back to art because, if that's okay, because as a scientist, I was pretty, you know, rational and didn't really think much about art until after the Exxon Valdez oil spill, the Copper River Delta region, Cordova, was selected by Artists for Nature Foundation as a site visit. And what that meant was the artists recognized the area had global significance for migratory birds, so waterfowl, the neotropical, all the birds funnel through. It's the West Coast Flyway, and and also the Copper River salmon and the salmon runs were globally significant, and they were threatened by development, oil development primarily, and so the issue was these artists wanted to come in because the people in Cordova had a different vision. And the vision was to build our economy in a way that matched our values. And we want to be a fishing community. We wanted to continue that route. And 4 years after the Exxon Valdez oil spill, our entire ecosystem collapsed, putting our fisheries and our lifestyle at huge risk. And we decided we wanted to rebuild that, and we wanted to rebuild it with businesses that would diversify our economy in a way that were compatible with commercial fishing. And the artist said, we will make art, and we will put a beautiful book together, and we will have this tour of our art. And I thought, at this point, any idea is a good idea, you know, so we'll try it. And I was stunned at how artwork opened up people's hearts, people whose minds were already set about what was, you know, good and what was bad. And suddenly, if you could pry open their hearts, their minds could change. So I learned that the minds follow the heart. And that was really important because 14 years after the Exxon Valdez oil spill, I was at the Cordova High School teaching before I launched on a national book tour. I thought I better try my talk on some students. And the high school kids struggled with my talk. And three of the boys came up afterward and said, we want to help. We want to get involved. And it turned out these were spill children. They were born or very young at the time of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and they grew up with this their whole life, this cloud hanging over their life of their parents arguing and no money and just dysfunction, general dysfunction.
I have to say, that's one of the real hidden, to most people, hidden effects of an oil spill is domestic violence, family problems, even suicides, and all those kinds of things that come from the loss of livelihood and habitat.
And Cordova became a case study in disaster trauma. And we are still, this year, 2011, will be our last year of the study that has been ongoing since 1989. And what the sociologists found out by studying us was that the stress of not knowing when you were going to be able to provide for your family, the financial stress actually caused as much trauma as the initial spill. So the financial stress from the litigation actually became as great as the original spill disaster. And as our ecosystem slowly began to recover, the stress from the litigation actually eclipsed the trauma from the oil spill.
And now, the litigation was a suit against Exxon.
The litigation was to make good on Exxon's promise, we will make you whole, which BP has told people in the Gulf, and BP is now advertising on media across the nation, making it right. And I flew down to the Gulf to challenge people to think, how much is your marriage worth? How much is your husband's life worth? Because how much is domestic violence and substance abuse worth? Because this is how this social dysfunction manifested in our community, with spikes in all these things. And there is no way that Exxon or BP can pay for a broken marriage or pay for somebody's suicide, but that is what's going to happen. So there really is no way to make an oil spill trauma right. And actually, we were only paid for short-term harm in the long run. We were never compensated for long-term damage, and that case sets precedent for what will happen to people in the Gulf.
And I have to say, I mean, if BP or Exxon had really wanted to make it whole or make it right rather than spending the money on expensive PR campaigns or spending the money on lawyers and litigation, why couldn't they just have paid out what would have actually made it right?
For the same reason, the big reason is that would have stripped the veil of illusion away of our oil dependency, that it's basically risk-free. It is not risk-free. There are all these costs that are borne disproportionately by the people who find themselves in harm's way when one of these accidents happen. And it's people who don't even have any say in it, like the children, the spill children, when they grew up in Cordova and they started asking these questions. Why do my parents argue? I go to ask my father to explain the oil spill, and he can't. He just gets mad at me. And so I started working with these children, and the children said to me, we cannot understand graphs and charts. You have to find another way to explain this to us. And that's when I fell back again on the power of art. And I realized that literally a picture is worth 1,000 words, and that the children, they would get that. And then they would go and explore the science. But it was all science, but it was just through the lens of art and photographs. And I have discovered now, thanks to the high school students in Cordova, that I actually can tell the story of Exxon Valdez oil spill and what really went wrong. And I'm talking not an environmental disaster, but a democracy crisis, to the point where our government has been hijacked by these big corporations. I can explain this down to fifth graders. Fifth graders understand that things with belly buttons have human rights, and things without belly buttons, like corporations, do not have constitutional rights, or should not have constitutional rights.
I was going to say, they do have constitutional rights as people. And
welcome to Citizens United.
And they shouldn't, yeah.
They shouldn't. And Citizens United was the most blatant example of the Supreme Court's complete fiction of this doctrine of corporate constitutional rights. The Supreme Court actually invented this doctrine back in 1886. And we have been going wrong as a country ever since then. And what I'm encouraging, that was like the final lesson in the Exxon Valdez, and the lesson that I carried to the Gulf of Mexico, was people finally started asking, as our court case dragged on and on and on, how did corporations get this big, where they can manipulate our legal system, our government, our political system, what happened in America? And I didn't know. I'm a biologist. So I went and studied and researched, and lo and behold, found that there are all these democracy activists who have been carrying this ball, well, actually all the way back to civil rights, if you will, where certain people were left out of our Constitution. The founders who wrote it actually represented only about 8% of the population, and Native Americans and African Americans and women and men without property, they were all left out. So our whole entire history has been one of people who were left out of our founding documents trying to get rights under it. And what the corporations did in 1886 was they decided wanted equal protection under the law, which is the 14th Amendment. And the Supreme Court, in a roundabout way, granted that. So, and since then, there's a whole body of case law that has systematically said, well, because corporations are persons, for example, with Citizens United, then therefore the corporate person is entitled to free speech, and since we, the Supreme Court, have ruled that money is speech, then if we restrict spending of money from the corporate person on our elections, in effect, we're restricting speech. So what the Supreme Court decided was that they couldn't do that because it would create a disadvantaged class of person, meaning the Fortune 500 companies. And so they granted unlimited speech as money, spending in our elections to corporate persons. In doing this, what the Citizen United case did was it effectively disabled all three branches of our government, because now we will have corporate-influenced elected politicians passing corporate lawyer-written laws that are interpreted by corporate-influenced elected judges.
Which we already have had.
But what we haven't had is, and interpreted by federal agencies that are also now under the influence of corporate money, to the extreme. I mean, the spending in our midterm election, well, I'm talking about 2010 now, after Citizen United, was on par with the presidential elections, which historically is always much more greater spending than the midterm elections. So we're all, and of that money, there was a much higher proportion of it that was from anonymous sources, which are corporate sources. They don't have to disclose now. And also, the spending was actually influenced in, was the deciding factor in a certain places where seats changed. So I think we're just beginning to see the beginning of that sort of opening the floodgates to corporate influence in our politics.
And what does that actually mean for phenomena like oil spills, past, present, and future?
Well, what this meant to me, and I saw it very clearly in the Gulf of Mexico when I was down there in early August, when Obama came out and said, it's all over, the oil is gone, and all of his people, and I'm talking about the Environmental Protection Agency, NOAA, the Coast Guard, all said it's over. Mother Nature will take care of that little residue. It's gone. And the media pretty much vanished. And I realized, oh my God, we as a nation have no exit strategy. Our government, no matter who is president, Republican, Democrat, it no longer matters. Our country's been hijacked. And on one case, and I feel like with Citizen United, this puts the problem in the face of America. And when I say the problem, let me just back up and say that it's not all over, it's not all gone, and that there are hundreds, if not thousands of people who are sick in the Gulf with what has been diagnosed back in May and June and July as food poisoning or heat stroke, or just a bad headache. They still have these symptoms, and we're talking now 11 months later, and I believe what has emerged is a chemical illness epidemic among the public. It's not just the workers who are sick, it's the public across the Gulf. And we're talking literally millions of people potentially whose health is at risk from this. This is not going away. And one of the things that I will be doing and talking about tomorrow night, a little bit at the very end, is the teach-in that I am co-hosting with people in the Gulf. But it's a national webinar that people can download across America. It's going to be 1 hour of the real Gulf story, what really happened, the untold stories that got shut down by this declaration that it's all over. Then we're going to look around the rest of America and say, really, is this Gulf situation unique? Or is this happening across America where we are sacrificing people's health and the environment for our oil dependency?
And it's also, if I may say, not only oil, but coal, natural gas. When we talk about hydraulic fracturing, there are analogous stories that have to do with the water being poisoned. When we talk about mountaintop mining, there's all sorts of water and air pollution. And also, to go back to something that you, Ricky, said before, places where people said, well, we can always go back to hunting, trapping, and fishing, in these same mountaintop coal mining places, that's gone too.
But it's also that we have sacrificed democracy so that we have ecological, environmental, social, economic, every aspect of our present contemporary life and all of the dreams and all of the models of democracy are being sacrificed. And one of the things that is so important is that artists who have always lived and worked on the margins, they've rarely been at the center and well paid and well respected, they've been these commentators on the side. And when the media steps away and says, okay, it's all good, relax folks, everybody go back to making money, it's the artists who are sticking with it, because for them, their job is to explicate complicated, complex phenomenon in a way that, as you said, Ricky, can not only touch the mind, but touch the heart.
And that is exactly the stories that we are going to be capturing in the second hour of Changing the Endgame, the national teach-in, are these stories of fracking and mountaintop removal. All these stories. It's happening across America. It's the biggest untold story, I think, is the cost, the true cost of our oil dependency, and including sacrificing our democracy. And then finally, hour three will be Changing the Endgame, the solutions, which are also the untold story, where people in America are saying in different communities, enough, enough, I see what's going on. And they're getting together with their neighbors, and they're focusing on what they can agree on rather than what divides them. And they're finding that this is a very powerful force, and it allows them to identify shared values, create a common vision like we did in Cordoba, where we said, we want to become a commercial fishing industry again after the demise of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. What will it take to do that? What steps? And we agreed on action steps. And people across America are taking steps that can be repeated in other communities. These are the stories we're going to capture in Changing the Endgame to show Americans that, hey, we can be doing this in any community. It's not waiting for the president to make a move. This was the biggest lesson, I think, from the Exxon Valdez, and it's definitely repeating in the Gulf of Mexico, is that we as a people sat back and said, oh, well, we're hurt. And BP, or in case of us, Exxon, promised to make us whole. So we'll sit back and wait till that happens. We have Congress promising to do something about our oil dependency. It's not happening. So the power of us, the power in a democracy is in the people, and it's in the local communities. That's where we have our power. So there's a people's movement brewing, movetoamend.org, and that movement is about helping people grow, turn their backs on the power structures, and grow communities to human scale based on human values, practicing real democracy, and bringing this vision up. Just like the abolitionists and the suffragists, they didn't go to Congress and ask for a slavery protection act. You know, they said, no, it's wrong. We need to fix it. And what we're talking about now is ultimately driving a new right into the Constitution and saying that, affirming that only human persons have constitutional rights, not non-living entities such as corporations.
We're talking to Ricky Ott, biologist, and Diane Karp of the Santa Fe Art Institute about the event that's happening tomorrow night called Oil Spill Information Gulf. It's a panel discussion, and it's at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall. One of the other people who's going to be there whom we haven't talked about yet
is Tricia Watts. Tricia Watts is one of the primaries of a small arts organization called Eco Art Space, and they do a lot of exhibitions and bring together scientists and artists. One of the beauties of these combinations is that these are both powerful problem solvers. Artists and scientists approach their problems sometimes from the very same perspective, sometimes from differing perspectives, but they're about how does one elicit change? How does one solve a problem? How does one engage in finding solutions that are not the likely solutions? They're not the typical solutions. And the result is that when they work together, the outcome is extraordinary. And it is a visioning process that opens up the problem itself in a way that is utterly revelatory.
So we're looking forward to seeing everybody at the event tomorrow night at Tipton Hall at 6 o'clock. Ricky Ott, you have done so much work. You've been such an incredible activist. Once again, as we were saying at the beginning of the program, you actually received an award from the Huffington Post. It was the Environmental Game Changer Award. How do people, I mean, there's so many of us who would like to get involved, and indeed, I would love to see a study on the public health impacts of solar and wind energy, for example. What happens when you stop polluting water and the effects on the national budget when you stop polluting water. In other words, not only is it a human cost where people are unhealthy, but it's this huge financial cost because all of us pay for it through our taxes. Anyway, how can we citizens get involved in your work and in this work that you're doing? Do you have websites, links? You talked about this webinar. How do people get in?
There are several websites. For people who want to learn more about the evolution of corporate personhood and the demise of democracy, I suggest you go to ultimatecivics.org. Ultimate Civics is ultimate because we're playing for the democracy and the planet. Another website is movetoamend.org. Move to Amend is the national grassroots coalition of activists across the country who are finding another way to live more sustainably and to reduce their fossil fuel footprint. And finally, ultimately changingtheendgame.org will have a huge archive of people who are actually rolled up their sleeves and are making a difference in community after community. For example, one of the archive spots will be Dreaming New Mexico, which is right here in Santa Fe, as is Bioneers right here in Santa Fe. So it's a matter of turning the corporate-controlled news off and spending more time at your computer researching what's happening in your own backyard. It's actually a very positive story across the nation as the old system collapses, and I believe we have not seen the last of the economic collapses. Capitalism is right. Not sustainable. People, we need to focus more on what is growing up, and it's growing up all across the nation. It's very exciting. It's very empowering, and I encourage people to do democracy in their own community.
Ricky Ott, community activist and former commercial salmon fisherman, the author of the book Not One Drop, Betrayal and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill, and Diane Karp from the Santa Fe Art Institute. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and we'll see you tomorrow night.
Art is democracy in action. Make art.
I look forward to seeing everybody tomorrow so we can figure out how to do democracy together.
Excellent. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.